Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Technology is all over these days. iPhones, Androids, Fitbits, smart thermostats. Billionaire, entrepreneur, investor Peter Thiel says it's not enough. Not if we want to create, thrive, survive on this planet. Marginal innovation, he says, won't do it. We need big, new, ground-up technology breakthroughs. He doesn't trust government. He doesn't trust the corporate world exactly. It's going to take entrepreneurs, startups, he says, to save us. This hour on Point, technology techno-libertarian Peter Thiel and his view of what it will take to save, build a future. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Will technology be our salvation? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. A special welcome to our new live listeners in the Dayton region on WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Peter Thiel, entrepreneur, investor, billionaire, a PayPal founder, the first big outside money in Facebook. He spotted, funded Mark Zuckerberg in early with Elon Musk at SpaceX, the founder of Tesla, libertarian, often contrarian. His new book is Zero to One with Blake Masters. It's all about startups, the future of technology, and he says the future itself. Peter Thiel, welcome back to On Point.
Tom, thanks for having me on the show.
There's a lot in here about starting up companies and, in your view, the tremendous importance of that. I kind of want to go to the end first, if we could, Peter. You describe, you know, several ways that the history, progress, or the lack thereof can work and where we stand now. And you make it a kind of a do-or-die equation. You look at how the ancients saw human progress or the path of human life on Earth. You look at a plateau that we may be on now and some people accept now, at an extinction scenario, at a takeoff scenario. Could you walk us through those, Peter?
Well, we've been living in an accelerating technological civilization for 2 to 3 centuries, maybe since, you know, the 17th, 18th century when science and technology really started to take off. And I believe it's still advancing, but at a slower rate than it had in the past. And in the last 40 years, it has been a story of computers, information technology, the internet, the mobile internet. But many other areas of technology have decelerated a lot. There's been not enough innovation in energy, in clean technology, not that much innovation in transportation, not that much innovation in all the futuristic technologies people imagined in the 60s, space travel, robotics, underwater cities, turning the deserts into farmland or forests. And so we've had innovation in the world of bits, but not in atoms. And the word technology has a narrower meaning today than it did 40 or 50 years ago. It basically just means computers, which reflects this narrow range of progress. Now my view is that you know, with 7 billion people on this planet, we cannot go back. I'm not a techno-utopian. I don't think technology is a panacea. I think sometimes it leads to very bad things. Nuclear weapons were, I think, a bad invention that didn't make the world a better place. But I think without more technology, we are really in trouble because we have to figure out new energy sources, new ways to feed the 7 billion people, to take the developing nations to the living standards of the Western world and beyond. And so I think that while technology is not perfect, without more technological progress, there can be no good future.
Describe the dynamics of that. You say we are on an unsustainable path now. Why, Peter Thiel?
Well, you can simply look at China and the U.S. to just take two countries. China's plan is to become like the U.S., but if everybody in China drove a car like we have in the U.S., you'd run out of oil, or you'd run into enormous environmental problems with climate change and carbon dioxide emissions and so on. So for China to catch up to the U.S., you actually need to develop new technologies, and not just in the computer area. You need to do them in all these other areas. You know, the cell phones that distract us from our surroundings also distract us from all the ways in which our surroundings are strangely old, in which we live in cities that look like they're hundred years old, subway systems that are decrepit, not quite working, things like that.
There is an extinction scenario in your couple pages of charts here, and you take it seriously. What dimensions there?
Well, certainly there are all these bad scenarios for technology. There are runaway technology scenarios where it could lead to violence and war that could destroy the world. You have a worrisome scenario with artificial intelligence if that gets to be too dangerous. But I think that in a world of scarce resources, you have a much greater risk of conflict. And I think the way to overcome scarcity is through technology, through innovation. And so we need to, you know, we don't want to have a Malthusian sort of a problem. We want to take it seriously, and so we want to try to overcome it.
You describe what I would call maybe a mindset problem here, where people sort of in the developed world, things are certainly imperfect, but people kind of like their lifestyle and they're sort of happy to look out and see a sort of plateau chart line here, and they're all right with that. What's the problem?
Well, certainly if you think everything's fine, then you're likely not to try that hard. You will have low expectations, and the low expectations will be met. I think there certainly are many areas where I think we could be doing so much better. The example I always give that's fairly straightforward is biomedical innovation. You know, we declared war on cancer in 1970. It was supposed to be defeated by the bicentennial. You know, it's 44 years later, but we could be making so much more progress there. It would be inconceivable for someone to declare, for a president of the U.S. today to declare war on Alzheimer's. Our expectations are so much reduced for what we can do, even though one third of all the people at age 85 have dementia. And I don't think this is acceptable. But I agree with you that we live in a country where, by and large, people seem to accept this. A society where, by and large, people seem to accept this. People don't like technology. They don't like science. If you look at the Hollywood films, they always show technology that destroys things, that doesn't work, that's dystopian. It's The Matrix or Terminator or Avatar. I watched the Gravity movie the other day. Mm-hmm. You were happy to be back on a muddy island. You'd never want to go into outer space, you know. And I think we have this very conservative bias, in the sense of not wanting anything to change. And yet I think there are so many ways things could change for the better.
Why do you think we, and I'm not sure exactly what we means in this case, but the kind of the world in your analysis fell off, but certainly the United States in your analysis fell off that gung-ho technology, let's think of it and then do it track, you say, in the early 70s. Why?
Well, I think there were probably a whole set of things that came together. There was environmental damage people became more aware of. There was the nuclear weapons danger people became more aware of. There was a way in which our society became somewhat more risk averse. We sort of replaced the scientists and engineers with lawyers and bankers. It became more financially oriented, less oriented towards certain other things. I think there were probably a whole set of reasons why it happened. It's quite hard to figure all of them out. But I think it sort of hasn't quite worked. And I think the crisis of 2008 shows that we can't simply progress by doing more of the same. If you build more houses, you do more of the exact same thing. There's some point where the sort of tracked horizontal growth that we've had runs into a limit. And so I think there is at this point at least an opening to this idea that we need to just try to do some new things in the U.S., Western Europe, Japan, all these other places that are facing, in the alternative, this sort of secular stagnation at best.
You say the crisis of 2008 could look like peanuts if we don't go in a different direction. What would that direction look like that you're pushing, promoting here?
Well, it is basically just working on starting, you know, many new ventures in all these different areas. One of my colleagues from PayPal, Elon Musk, started SpaceX and Tesla, which I think are both incredibly inspiring companies that, you know, the sort of the very tangible products. One builds rockets, the other one's the electric car manufacturer, and they both represent significant sort of quantum step improvements over the next best alternative. And it's very inspiring, and yet it's also somehow quite rare. There aren't many things like this being done. And I think and this is where I'm again more optimistic. I actually think there's a lot like that that could be done. And it's not a law of nature that we can't have 100 companies that are as dramatic as a Tesla. It's just that we sort of resigned ourselves to not wanting it.
The sort of Buck Rogers positive sci-fi future. You say we're not in the future until we get there, and we could have and could still do it.
It's possible that that some of these things just don't work. I mean, maybe jetpacks are just a bad idea, and you shouldn't have a jetpack. You know, we have a tagline on our website. You know, they promised us flying cars. All we got was 140 characters. Flying cars are maybe, you know, maybe they're good, maybe they're bad. But it's remarkable how all the various things people envisioned, we've gotten so few of them outside of the computer area. And so I think we could be doing more. I think we could be doing more on clean energy. I think we could be doing more on biomedical. I think we could be doing more in many of these areas.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with super entrepreneur investor Peter Thiel about the future and what we're going to make of it. He says basically, technology or die, big breakthroughs, or we are in trouble. He's out with a new book. It is 0 to 1, Note on Startups, Notes on R, How to Build the Future with Blake Masters. Came out of a series of lectures he did at Stanford a few years back. Blake Masters was in the room, in the hall, took notes, they got together, and now here it is. You can read it. He's with us from San Francisco today. He is libertarian. He is contrarian. Can be kind of saucy. Here he is on CNBC's Squawk Box earlier this month talking about Twitter and pot.
Twitter's hard to evaluate. They have a lot of potential. It's a horribly mismanaged company. The people, you know, probably a lot of pot smoking going on there. But but it doesn't.
What do you really think?
But it's such a solid franchise, right, that maybe it works even with all that.
Peter, I saw you bounce back there and say, oh, it's a great franchise. Did you hear from Twitter on that front, the pot smoking aside?
Well, the CEO, Dick Costolo, it was very funny. He sort of tweeted back saying that he didn't have time to get back to me since he was busy eating a big bag of Doritos.
Right, or something sweeter. I want to ask you about a few things we've all heard recently. This was September 9th, Cupertino, California, Apple CEO Tim Cook unveiling the latest iPhones.
These are the new iPhones, the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6 Plus. They are, without a doubt, the best iPhones we've ever done. And I hope you'll agree, they're the best phones you have ever seen.
Apple CEO Tim Cook with another Hubba Hubba iPhone press conference. Is this it, Peter Thiel?
Well, I feel it's always unfair to attack Tim Cook because he has almost impossibly large shoes to fill in replacing Steve Jobs. But certainly the iPhone 6, it's an improvement. It is no doubt the best one, but it's not as big a step as, let's say, the first iPhone was. And, you know, you sure may have bigger screens. And so this is much more of an incremental improvement. It's very hard, by the way, once you're at a size of Apple, to come up with innovations that are big enough to really move the dial. You're making, you know, $150 billion a year from iPhones. Very hard to move the dial. But certainly, we need more than just phones with bigger screens to move it. And it's always unfair to, you know, blame Twitter or blame Apple as the sole problem because they are trying. Maybe it's like all the rest of us who should also be trying a little bit more.
How about this one then? September 19th, CNBC. This is founder chairman of the Chinese giant Alibaba, Jack Ma.
We hope 15 years later, they say this is the company like Microsoft, like IBM, like Walmart. They change shape the world.
Alibaba, is this a world changer by your standard, Peter?
Well, it's an enormously successful company that will be likely to be important for many decades to come. I think most of the business in China have simply copied models from the U.S. It's the internet in China is is seen as economically somewhat less important, but politically more important. And so it's always very closely tied in with the Chinese government. I think Alibaba will remain protected by the Chinese government, and it probably will be a good investment. But it's sort of a globalization play where, you know, China does not need to invest in the way in which the U.S. does, because in the next 10 to 20 years, they're still poor. They have so much room to catch up just by copying things. They may run into, you know, energy constraints, other things like that. But on the computer side, they can just copy things. It's in the U.S., in the developed world, that we need to innovate.
Let me ask you then about a front on which I know you do – I think you see breakthrough technology. You mentioned Elon Musk and SpaceX. You're a big investor in that company. Here was Elon Musk. This was a CNBC over the summer.
I'm hopeful that the first people could be taken to Mars in 10 to 12 years. I think it's certainly possible for that to occur. But the thing that really matters in the long term is to have a self-sustaining city on Mars, to make life multiplanetary.
There's Elon Musk, Mr. Tesla, Mr. SpaceX. It sounds very cool. Does this save humanity, self-sustaining cities on Mars, Peter Thiel?
Well, it's certainly look, I'm going to be very biased here since I am an investor in SpaceX, but it certainly is a picture of the future that looks very different from the present in a very concrete and very powerfully dramatic way. And I think what I do agree with Elon on is there's nothing automatic about it. It could happen. It could not happen. The future's – it's not – there's nothing automatic about the future just arriving in some way. It depends on human agency, on the desire to build it. And I think you know, Elon – the inspiration for SpaceX was to do something dramatic like that. That's what motivated some incredibly talented rocket scientists to work with Elon and getting the company to where it is. And I think you always want to have some magic like that, some transcendent sense of mission for these really great businesses. It's not you know, if it's just about making money, you don't have the magic.
I want to look at more at what this future would look like. And you say there is no future until we change the present. But if we can talk about the how for a minute, I mean, you're talking about what you analyze as sort of an untenable stagnation or plateau right now. Don't have enough resources for everybody to keep on this path. You talk about an extinction scenario. If we put the technology we do have to work and fight with each other over resources, you are not very trusting, to say the least, of government. You're famous as a techno-libertarian. You talk about cultural revolution, a cultural revolution being required here to build this future. Describe that cultural revolution.
Well, to build a better future, you have to, I think, first convince people that it's possible. You have to get people to work on it. So there's always a self-fulfilling aspect. If we think it's not possible, people won't work on it, and it won't happen. If we think it's possible, we will work on it, and it might very well happen. I don't think it's going to happen as a mass movement, as a mass political change. I think it's much more likely to happen in small groups, in, you know, new companies, new ventures, could be new nonprofits. But I think it's going to be much easier to convince small groups to work on, like Elon, starting with maybe 20 or 30 rocket scientists at the core of SpaceX, rather than some mass political movement. Now, I am libertarian. I am skeptical of our government's ability to do things. I'm not absolute or dogmatic about this. I would like actually to have a government that could do more, but I think a letter from Einstein to the White House mailroom would get lost. I think we couldn't do a Manhattan Project, we couldn't do an Apollo Project today, and so there has been this very strange decline in our government's ability to do these things. And I think it's again it's somehow our society is not as inspired by science or technology, which is why I think progress is more likely to happen in small groups in our time or not at all.
You're critical of the government. I want to look at why exactly you think that's happening. But you're also very critical of the corporate world here, the world of capitalism. There's a ton of money out there sitting on the sidelines, not being invested in the kind of future you're describing. Why isn't that happening?
Well, it's all these why questions are always a little bit harder to answer than one can say. I can start by saying it's not happening. It's remarkable, even with a lot of the tech giants like Microsoft or IBM or even Google or Apple, where you have enormous tens of billions of cash, and it gets used, it either just builds up. They occasionally use it to buy back their own shares, but I'd say to one approximation, it's like people are out of ideas. So it's not a shortage of money; it's much more a shortage of ideas.
Really, I mean, all the people on this planet all that money sitting there and all the guys like venture capital and investor guys like you who would love to put them together, I would think. Were that dull now?
Well, you know, I always cite Google as an example because I think it's still, as a company, pushing things a lot more. They're trying to build self-driving cars. They're trying to do all these different things. But they have, you know, they have $50 billion sitting in the bank. They're earning 0% interest on it. You're losing 2% a year with inflation. So it's like Bernanke or Yellen are begging Google, begging all these tech giants to do more with their money. And somehow it's that there just aren't enough ideas on what to do. And so they'd rather just have it slowly be eroded because they don't seem to have a better idea.
You describe it as a political/cultural problem. How?
Well, it's a cultural problem in that we're not inspired by the future for the most part. It's again, science fiction as a genre has collapsed, most of us don't take our bearings from this. I think Silicon Valley in the United States is deeply countercultural. It is it's in a way very different from what much of the rest of the developed world feels like. Politically, Washington D.C. and Silicon Valley are very different places. Silicon Valley is dominated by substance, by engineers, by sort of solving actual problems. Washington D.C. is dominated by process, by legislation, and so it's like lawyers versus engineers. These are just radically different cultures at this point.
Let's go to a caller. Lots of callers here. We'll go to one in Plano, Texas. Matthew is calling. Matthew, you're on the air with Peter Thiel.
Yes. Hi. Thank you, Tom. Love the show. I am really fascinated in why do we as human beings expect, we've come to expect innovation to be a linear process. I was wondering if Peter could kind of address that.
Peter?
Well, it's certainly not reasonable to think of it as linear. I mean, it can go in jumps and starts. I would say most of history, most human societies have been in times where there was no innovation. They were essentially stagnant. You know, things did not change from generation to generation. We had an accelerating progress for a few hundred years. And I think the default that a lot of people have is that it keeps going and keeps going almost automatically. There's a Moore's law in computers where, you know, computer speeds doubled every 18 months. It's not quite working anymore, but people sort of saw this thing, and you sort of extrapolate these lines. Life expectancies grew from, you know, 46 years in 1840 to high 80s among women in Sweden and Japan. So they have grown in a straight line by 2.5 years a decade for 160 years. So there's a linear trend. So every day you survive, your life expectancy goes up 6 hours. But it's not automatic. It actually requires people to work on things. I think it could go faster or it could go slower. It's really up to us.
Matthew, I appreciate your call. Liberty in Providence, Rhode Island. Liberty, you're on with Peter Thiel.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I have to say that I'm very frustrated. The lack of innovation in our time is connected with the corporate takeover of industry, government, and academia. Independent inventors like my own husband, Paul Klinkman, are ignored. Only those with ties to a powerful corporation or a prestigious university even have a chance of getting their ideas considered. Renewable energy especially has been stifled by special interests since the late 1970s. My husband alone has several inventions which could make a huge difference to our economy, environment, and energy development. We're struggling to develop a couple of them ourselves, including a newly patented solar greenhouse, a heat-storing solar thermal heat and hot water system, and a newly patented means of producing cheap commercial
electricity. So, Liberty, when you hear Peter say, "Let's go, let's do it," you know, unleash your husband and his inventions. what are you running into?
We're running into nobody is willing to take a chance. This country no longer is willing to say, "Hey, that's a new idea. Maybe it'll work or not. Let's try it."
Liberty, we hope it takes off, and I appreciate your call. Peter, there's Liberty, and she says on every side she sees innovation hemmed in, including by business, special interests. How do you get around that?
Yeah, well, I'm very sympathetic to what she's saying. It's obviously hard to evaluate mm-hmm. the precise merits of her husband's invention on the air right now, but I think the sort of eccentric scientist, the eccentric professor, is a species that's fast going extinct. And we sort of have people who are very nimble at navigating the politics of writing grants, at sort of fitting in with our corporate and political class that are getting funded. Whereas I think a lot of the ideas come from things that are more unconventional. You know, if you have a peer review process in which you say, we'll do experiments if everyone thinks the experiment's going to work, you will get experiments that are not very bold, not very very exciting. So I think there are some things that are very screwed up in the funding processes on the corporate level, on the government level, on the university level.
But Liberty's not talking about peer review. She's talking about capitalism not working here, special interests as she sees it, and you could disagree, but getting in the way of innovation. You're all for capitalism, but if you hand it over and then special interests sort of, you know, put a brick on the brakes, what happens?
Well, I think certainly a lot of large corporations are bureaucratic in much the same way our government is. They don't want things to be that different. They don't want to take any sorts of risks. And yes, there's a reason that a lot of special interests have gotten very powerful. I think they're able to tap into a lot of the fears we have in our society against change. And so the special why are the special interests so effective? And I think it's in part.
But don't they help create those fears? I mean, you know, look at the fossil fuel ads on television. Would make you think that without what they're pumping, we're doomed. That's a kind of fear-mongering in itself, isn't it?
They create those fears, but there's also part of our society that doesn't believe things can be that much better. So they're able to have more traction than they would have had in the 50s or 60s. So I think it's all like these things are – there's not a single cause. I don't think you can blame any single cause. I think it's very overdetermined.
But does capitalism fix it? You raise that flag here, and people these days have come to be skeptical about where it takes us.
Well, I don't think corporatism fixes it, and that's why I'm in favor of finding ways to start new businesses. I don't think it's fixed within large existing institutions. So I'm skeptical of corporatism. I'm skeptical of our large government institutions. I'm skeptical of our large universities, our large nonprofit institutions.
And there's the libertarian for you. Is there a country in the world you can point to that's close to doing it right?
Well, the U.S. is still doing it better than most places. I like Scandinavia. I like Israel. I like, I think there are sort of pockets where things are being done. But the U.S., U.S. has always been the country where people do new things. It's been the frontier country. And that is sort of our comparative advantage in the world, that we're the place where you do new things. And so if we lose that, we lose something really essential about this country.
Is democracy now part of the problem? You've said things over time that lead people to think that you're not so persuaded by democracy at this point.
I don't think it's I think that's not really an issue with democracy. We live in a complex representational constitutional republic. We don't live in a strict democracy, but yes, when you build a new business, when you pursue a new scientific invention or a new engineering thing, that's not democratic. That's you have some person who's going against the grain.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with techno-libertarian Peter Thiel about the future. He's a big investor, a big entrepreneur, and he's got big ideas about what we're going to make of the future or not. He says basically technology is the way or die, big breakthroughs, or we are in trouble. He's out with a new book with Blake Masters. It's called Zero to One, i.e. the startup world. Go from nothing to something. Only startups do that, he says. Peter, let me ask you about this one. Just last week, the Japanese construction firm Obayashi announced it will have an elevator to space, long nanotech cables, something like 50 miles up. Here's a report from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
Japanese construction giant Obayashi says the elevator will reach 96,000 kilometers into space. Robotic cars will carry people and cargo at a fraction of the cost of rockets to a newly built space station. The company says the fantasy can become a reality because of the development of carbon nanotechnology.
Carbon nanotechnology. Peter, is that it? Is that the real deal, in your view?
Well, a space elevator would be a phenomenal achievement, and that would definitely be an enormous amount of progress. There are a lot of things like this, though, that have this science fiction feel that we talk about, that and they're always just in the future. They're always just about to happen. And so, people have been talking about space elevator for 20 or 30 years. I don't think there's anything about it that's impossible. But the fact that we're talking about it, it doesn't mean that it's about to be built. Or that, and that's not enough to bring us back to acceleration.
And then there's you talking about your vision of the way toward success here. Earlier this month, you were talking with the technology news site TechCrunch about competition and monopoly. Got a lot of people talking, saying competition's not the way.
Most people think that business is about competition, whereas I think business is about getting away from competition. I think successful businesses are monopolies of one sort or another. Unsuccessful businesses are ones that are in some hyper-competitive context.
So business for who? I mean, who? You don't want competition. I guess you're saying for a successful company. I mean, everybody gets that. If you're a monopoly, you got a ton of cash. You say capitalism requires a lot of capital. But does that work for the society as a whole?
Well, certainly, like in terms of advice to people starting companies, the goal, you should always aim for monopoly. If you're a founder or an entrepreneur, you'd much rather be building a monopoly like Google than a hyper-competitive business. And the bad example I always use is something in the restaurant industry. Monopolies are bad for society when they become too static, when they become rent collectors or toll collectors of one sort or another, when it's like the Parker Brothers board game. I think they're good, though, when they invent new things. And so as a government, we are skeptical of bad monopolies, but we actually give people legal monopolies with copyright laws, patent laws, trademark laws. And so if you invent something new, your reward is to have a monopoly in that. And so I think that should always be the goal. And I always think you shouldn't always – when you compete too much, you're always very focused on the people around you. It's like in your high school swim team, are you going to be a faster swimmer? And then the corporate version is, what are you going to do? I'll do the same thing as someone else, just with a tiny difference. I'll build the fourth online pet food company, the 10th thin film solar panel company, and I think it's always much better to do something that's more unique, both for society and for even more narrowly for the business you're building.
Of course, you've got people standing up for competition too. You wrote this in the Wall Street Journal. Desla Maglicki in Bloomington, Indiana, wrote back in the letters, "Competition is what protects the customer, provides the customer with freedom to choose." You've been critical of airlines. He says the reason why airline company services are so alike is that they all fly the same planes built by two near monopolies, Boeing and Airbus. I mean, he's got a point.
Well, there's a lot that one could say about the airline industry. It's probably very heavily, there's a corporate version, there's a government version where it's been heavily regulated. We don't have the Concorde anymore. But yes, I think there are points where things are, but it's I would argue that airlines have been, even though they're very similar, they have been rather competitive. People have not made money in airlines in 100 years. The Wright brothers made no money. The cumulative profits of the U.S. airline industry have been approximately zero for 100 years, and so it's been ferociously competitive, but you've actually had surprisingly little progress.
You've got people listening and wondering who this is going to work for. You write a lot about the singularity, this kind of super AI future, maybe even hybridizing of human and machine intelligence. You write a lot about talk a lot about space. Matthew writes to us on Facebook. Hey, you made it happen, so you can't complain, Facebook, I guess. But he says, going to Mars is great and all, but why won't these masters of the universe get us high-speed rail? What about for the masses of that 7 billion people on the planet, Peter?
Well, I don't think that, I think that when you develop new technologies, they may not benefit everybody Immediately, but they do benefit people over time. You know, in the 1980s, it was only very high-end cars that had airbags, like Mercedes or BMW. Gradually, those become cheaper and become available for people more broadly. And I think, you know, the same will happen with a lot of these medical technologies. If they're, you know, as they get developed, I think they will be broadly accessible. And I think that's been the history of technology, is that if you're able to do things more cheaply, if you're able to do more for less, which is my definition of technology, it ultimately improves living standards for people across the board.
You've got some tough ones here. Here's another listener on Facebook looking at your first big score with PayPal. One of the co-founders there says, look, Teal, talking about you, is a very wealthy guy for making a standard payment system, credit cards, work inefficiently for people who were scared of the early internet. Right place, right time. And he, in this message today, he says, just rehashes crap robber barons of the Gilded Age already said. What about that critique that this is sort of robber baron speak that doesn't go to sort of the roots of change? Even those who say, and we've heard them recently right here, Naomi Klein was with us, I think, a week ago, right in this hour, saying capitalism isn't cutting anymore. It's dragging us down.
Well, look, I think I would obviously beg to disagree with this. I think that that PayPal did involve some pretty big breakthroughs. We were able to combine money with email. We were able to enable anyone to accept a credit card, not just people who were set up to be merchant processors. So it sort of created an online payment system. There were some very tricky fraud problems that needed to be solved. And you know, it is always the case when, you know, there is something about software when people develop these things. There are some large fortunes that have been created, but I think it's also been good for society. I think the problem in our society is not the sort of inequality; it's the sense of stagnation. The thing that you know, people are really frustrated about is how they can't get ahead, how they see their kids not having lives better than their parents. And I think the stagnation is because there's not enough technological progress, not because there's too much.
I mean, it's easy to say the problem is not inequality, perhaps when you're a billionaire. I don't mean that too flippantly, but for people struggling with static wages for a long, long time, that certainly feels painful.
Well, but I agree with that. I think the problem is stagnation. The problem is that they're not seeing progress. But I think it's not. You know, even if you redistributed all the wealth in the U.S., people wouldn't be that much better off. The incomes have gone up 20% in the last 40 years. The median incomes have been flat. The mean has gone up 20%, which is, so there's been some increase in inequality. But the larger truth is just that things have been really stagnant.
How does your path get away from that? I mean, a lot of critics of inequality are not necessarily redistribution crazy. They just want to see an economy that's working so people do well in the main, not just at the tip top. How does yours create that? If you bring on all this artificial intelligence and we head off to space, what portion of society is going to fully benefit from that? We've seen a lot of technological progress cut jobs and apparently concentrate wealth. I mean, I hate to say it, but don't you see that too?
I do not agree with that. I start by saying that I don't think we've had that much technological progress. Mm-hmm. I think middle-class jobs are under pressure mainly because of globalization, mainly because of competition from China and India. You know, and it's true that there are places where computers have replaced people. So, you know, you don't have tellers at banks anymore because you have automated teller machines. On the other hand, you have more people working in banks than 40 years ago, and they've sort of been trained to do other kinds of services, and they're actually somewhat better jobs than they had before. So I think technology has not, you know, we always blame technology, but I think it's really some very different things that are driving this.
Phil in Waltham, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Phil. You're on with Peter Thiel.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Peter. I'm a historian, and there's two kind of assumptions that I wanted to get at in Peter's vision, his cyber-libertarian vision of social change. And the first one is that this idea that technology is profoundly neutral, and in history we've seen that this is not true. You know, we've seen business owners who specifically embrace certain technologies to displace the power of organized labor. And the other thing that we see in this vision is that this idea that markets are natural, that they're somehow inherent, and really what we see in history is that they're social constructs. And the biggest problem that we see today is this idea that we have this free market, but at the same problem, we have this externality of carbon pollution, which is really destroying the climate. So I was hoping that he'd be willing to speak to those two assumptions.
I'll take it to him, Phil, but what's your concern then about the formula you hear him laying out the vision?
So the concern would be that, okay, we have this neutral technology that will lead us to where markets want it to go, but since markets are inherently political as well as technology, they are going to benefit those in power, and there's not going to be an equal distribution of progress, and that fundamentally the average people are not going to benefit from this system. And I would also argue that we've seen this vision of change before. And it was with the counterculture, which Silicon Valley is directly a product of. But you had people like Stuart Brand who said, if we just embrace the right technologies, we're going to create this fantastic new civilization that's far more democratic. And, you know, some of these technologies are wonderful, Tesla, SolarCity, but it has not fundamentally changed the underlying power structure.
Peter Thiel, Phil, thank you. Peter Thiel, that's a lot, but please respond.
Well, look, I think that technology has not changed things that much in the last 40 years because we haven't had that much technological progress. And yes, I've never claimed that technology is neutral. There are some technologies that are problematic. I think most of them are actually good. But I think it's also not neutral to do nothing. And I think the alternative is always we don't develop anything new. We don't develop new food. We don't develop new forms of energy. And that's condemning the 6 billion people in the emerging world to permanent poverty, and it's condemning the next generations in this country to a lower standard of living than we currently have. And so I think the default of just continuing to coast and not doing anything is far from neutral as well.
But the period that you so admire, that you see having peaked out in the 1970s, there were tremendous advances there in the way we moved and moved energy and understood energy and all the rest. And yet that 20th century period up to 1972 saw gigantic wars, a lot of concern about where technology was taking us. No,
obviously that's true. And I think the nuclear history played a very big role in turning people against technology.
What's the antidote to that kind of?
I don't think you throw out the baby or with the bathwater, or you don't throw all of it out. So it's obviously the case that you have to think about what parts you want to keep, what parts you don't want to. But you couldn't get a polio vaccine approved today. When they first tried it in the 50s, they got the dosage wrong. They killed a bunch of people. If that happened today, you'd freeze it and you'd say we're not going to try it again for another 20 years. So I do think we've become too risk averse. We've become too scared of the future, and I think that's not the best place to be.
Michael in Austin, Texas. Michael, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi Tom. I think a lot of the other points have been made. What I'd like to really talk about now is what Peter said earlier, which is we need to learn to do more with less. So, and he was also right in that the Chinese copy technology. Well, the one thing the Chinese are copying is back in the 50s and 60s, Oak Ridge National Laboratories started up a molten salt reactor technology, which is a safe nuclear power. And China is now fast-tracking development of these nuclear technologies to be able to power their nation. And we are going to be the ones left behind in this. And I believe that the next big revolution, we need to be using more power, not less, but we need to be doing it safely and cheaply. And nuclear is the only thing that gets us there.
But a different kind of nuclear. Michael, thanks for your call from Austin. Peter Thiel, who's getting their hooks into this future? If anybody, you say Israel, you say Scandinavia. Michael in Austin looks at China.
Certainly China is doing a fantastic job building out its nuclear industry. The remark, in the U.S., something like half the nuclear plants are going to be shut down in the next decade. And we should be trying to replace them with far more modern, far safer plants. There's the molten reactor designs are cheaper, more modular, and much safer. There are thorium-based model reactors you could develop using thorium, which is not weaponizable. You know, one of the big problems with uranium and plutonium is that you always had the dual use where it could be used both for peaceful and military purposes. That's why thorium was underexplored in the 1950s. We could be doing a lot with thorium. And I think even fusion power, which is a little bit more futuristic, it's not clear to me that that can't be done. I don't think, and again, I think there's probably are some very different designs to be working at. But yes, I think that and you know, in terms of doing more with less, there's always the Atoms for Peace speech that Eisenhower gave in 1954, where he said that you know we want to have electricity that's too cheap to meter. And I think that's still a worthwhile goal. Again, doing more with less, and less meaning it costs less and less for more energy.
Peter, we've just got half a minute, but speak to those online. And there are quite a few, I have to say, who aren't certain that you're really endorsing democracy here. Does this vision, your vision of the future, does it include democracy?
Well, it's not going to get voted on. You know, we're not going to have this is not, you know, the future does not get built in some sort of deliberative process. But that's not how we make decisions in our society. We live in a super complex, technologically advanced world, and you can't vote on everything.
Should we? Should we vote on enough to keep the name democracy, even as a republic?
Well, we have a constitutional republic. We don't have a democracy. Mm-hmm. We should be. You should vote on some things, but a lot of these things, unfortunately, are going to be cited in very different ways, and that's just the nature of an advanced technological civilization.
Techno libertarian Peter Thiel with Blake Masters. The new book is 0 to 1. He joined us from San Francisco. Peter Thiel, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.